How do you stop a child from committing a crime? It's a million-dollar question, and finding an answer we can all agree on is far from simple. A report has detailed the consequences of getting that answer wrong. The cost of detaining young people in jails or community-based supervision has shot up dramatically in the past 5 years, despite the actual number of people in the system declining. So if getting to these kids too late is costing us both financially and in community safety, just how early do we need to be intervening? High school? Primary school? Kindy? The Queensland government's announced it will build crime prevention high schools, but one of my next guests says you need to start crime prevention when kids are as young as 4. Emeritus Professor Ross Hommel is the now retired Foundation Professor in Criminology and Criminal Justice at Griffith University, who led a decades-long early intervention and early prevention program in Queensland. And Dr. Caroline Krauser-Barlow is the CEO of The Front Project, who co-authored the Cost of Late Intervention report. Ross, I'll start with you. This research you've been doing over decades, I feel like if you've been doing it for this long, we should have it all sorted by now.
Yes, it's one of the more discouraging aspects of this work, that it's taking decades to bring about change. But new reports like the Front Project and many, many others are really putting prevention, the importance of prevention, right up in front. We hear it with mental health. The mental health system will never handle the number of young people in particular who have mental health disorders. We need to basically lay a strong foundation for healthy child and youth development. That's the best we can do to give kids the best chance of having a good life.
Caroline, the top line of your report is basically that it's costing us more to help fewer kids. What's going on here?
Yeah, so one of the big drivers of the increase in costs has been what's called community-based supervision. And actually, in some ways, it's a good sign, because what we're seeing is state governments investing more in probationary and diversionary programs, so more kind of intensive support for kids once they've hit that youth justice system, in terms of kind of, I guess, what you might call rehabilitation or building those life skills that might support them going forward. It also, of course, reflects kind of increased intensive supervision as well, and more electronic supervision. So we're seeing a lot more kind of, electronic tagging of children as we go. And so that's why the cost is going up. But clearly the cost, all of those investments would be made much better, much earlier in a child's life.
I think we can agree that if something has a cost, maybe that's an appropriate cost, but you're saying there's more cost-effective ways of helping kids.
Yeah, absolutely. So, there's been some really interesting studies done of children in youth justice. So most recently, the Kids Institute did a study of around 100 kids in youth justice, and they discovered that 9 in 10 of those kids had a serious neurodevelopmental impairment, and about a third of them have fetal alcohol syndrome, and that those had not been diagnosed or supported before. And similarly, when you look in terms of New South Wales has had a look at children who are 10 to 13 in court, and they found, 91% of those kids have been flagged by child protection as at risk, 40% had needed homelessness services, and 3/4 had parents who've been through the courts themselves. So what we can see is that children ending up in youth justice have actually been let down by the systems that are supposed to support them much earlier in their lives.
So what you're seeing is we're treating symptoms and not the root problem.
Yeah, exactly right. And I mean, I think it makes intuitive sense to people to think about, a child with unmet developmental needs, struggles at school, they act out, they're suspended, they fall further behind, the school door closes, just as family pressures like poverty and homelessness and all of those things mount. And so, I know that it can be easy sometimes to think that we're talking about mini Tony Sopranos. In fact, when we're talking about kids in youth justice, what we're really seeing is kids who are experiencing stress from all the different parts of their lives, and the offending is just the really pointy tip of some really deep-seated cycles of need that have been unmet on the way.
So, Ross, this report's about what happens when we don't intervene, but the work that you've done starting 25 years ago was really about what can happen when we get to kids early.
Yeah, and as I said before, laying a strong foundation for positive development. That's really how we frame what we did. We had funding initially from a foundation that was interested, surprisingly, in the problem of youth crime. So preventing crime was always a focus, but we didn't talk much about that. We talked about, as I said, positive development of children and child well-being. And what we did, we worked with a disadvantaged community in Brisbane early on in the early 2000s. And we spent a whole 12 months just learning about that community, talking to a lot of people, including the school teachers, the preschool teachers, and other service providers and parents, residents. We employed local students to develop and administer a survey. We were trying to find out what the community thought were the needs of children. And one of the things that came through most strongly was what Carol has just mentioned, the multi-problem families, the problem of poverty and the links between poverty and the whole range of issues that she mentioned. The other that was particularly emphasised by the preschool teachers was children's language and speech language and communication skills. They had noticed a very strong link between children who couldn't articulate, couldn't understand many words, even if English was their native language. These are four-year-olds, and their subsequent poor behaviour, again, as Carolyn mentioned. And there was quite a literature, particularly on the link between poor communication skills in preschool children, their readiness for school and their ability to flourish at school, particularly with reading and writing, but also numeracy, surprisingly, perhaps. And that link between school failure, being not ready for school, And the acting out, again, as Carolyn said, was also quite clearly documented in good research by the time we were developing this project. So really on the initiative of the Department of Education teachers that were talking to us, we were able to recruit the help of specialised communication teachers within the education system who themselves, on the basis of a postgraduate course that they'd done, at a one-year postgrad course in service training at Griffith University Education. They were able to design and deliver over a two-year period an enriched preschool program, which focused on speech, language and communication skills. It was preceded by thorough measurement of the language level of the child. And we found, in a nutshell, that there was a significant increase in their language skills at the end of the 12 months. It was a 30-week program, almost over the whole preschool year. And not only was there improvement in communication skills, as measured by the standardised test that was administered before and after, but there were very significant improvements in behaviour. Surprise, surprise. Now, the important thing is that those behavioural improvements were sustained throughout primary school. And when we got permission some years ago to link the data that we'd collected on the children and their families anonymously with youth justice records, We found more than a 50% reduction in the onset of serious or court-adjudicated youth crime by the age of 17. So quite a substantial effect. And the really interesting thing, that communication intervention for four-year-olds administered by professional, skilled teachers, I have to emphasise that, when combined with a very holistic, supportive form of family support that was offered through our community partner, Mission Australia, there was a zero rate of offending in that group. The subgroup of children who had done the communication program, whose parents also participated in the family support program, had a zero rate of offending, which is a remarkable result. I'm still not quite sure I fully believe it, but we actually do, I think, understand some of the mechanisms. And it was the tight integration of what went on in the home in terms of developing an enriched learning environment, as simple as mum reading to the kids at home. What went on in the preschool, the integration of those two settings turned out to be absolutely fundamental to the positive results that we observed.
You are listening to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, talking with Emeritus Professor Ross Hommel from Griffith University and Dr. Caroline Crozier-Barlow, who's the CEO of the Front Project, who's just published a new report into the increasing costs of basically youth crime and the outworking of that. One person says any prevention starts with parental responsibility and, if necessary, penalties for them not taking responsibility for behaviour of their children. Support and training for parents who are failing may help in some cases, as well as parenting and family issues options courses in schools. Ross, parenting. Some people have a really tight family with parents who are able to give this support. Some people don't.
Well, that's absolutely right. Look, I'm a great believer in parents taking responsibility. And it turns out all the parents we worked with wanted to. Even the heroin addicted mums and the ones with violent alcoholic partners and the terrible situations some of those families were in, all of those parents wanted the best outcome for their children. They didn't want for the child the sort of outcome they were experiencing as a young adult. Look, we're hardwired as a species, I think, for punishment responses. Effectively, what we're doing with the criminalisation of poor child behaviour is punishing poverty. And that, again, is in the front report. And the consequences of poverty. Now, I talk almost exclusively about early prevention. And that, as I said before, is about not early intervention. I just want to make that... we did not target children with problems or children with poor language skills. Their needs were catered for through a specialised form of input that was graded to the level of their language development. But we worked across the whole school system, preschool system, which was part of the primary school system in those days. And I think that's a really crucial point. We're working to improve the well-being of all children in the community, and that includes, so it turns out there's a bigger impact of universal interventions on the most at-risk children and families. Look, I could talk all day about this, but I think your respondent's question or response about accountability is a very understandable way of thinking about it. But as I said, I'll just repeat, parents want to be responsible, they want to be accountable, they need help, particularly in those early years and particularly in high poverty, high crime, violent settings. I just can't underline the importance of that. We're much better investing in prevention than we are in punishment.
Caroline, what does that look like from your perspective with the Front Project?
Yeah, so I really endorse what Ross is saying about the need to sort of build out and strengthen our universally available and community-based services. So the Murdoch Children's Research Institute has laid out a pathway for us in something called Restacking the Odds. And what they talk about is how maternal and child health home visits, really high quality early learning, local primary school that supports effective transition. We know that coming into primary school can be a tricky moment where kids start to disengage, supported play groups and parenting programs. When all of these places are set up to notice early, respond quickly, and walk alongside families, what we see is that they prevent escalation of behaviours and escalation of concerns. So I know it must sound a little bit kind of trite, but, you know, a supported playgroup isn't just songs and blocks. What you find in those environments is that you find a parent who can find connection with other parents in a similar situation, and we know that that social capital is really important in enabling parents to problem solve rather than kind of cycling into kind of increasing poor home environments. We find children getting the kind of extra stimulation they need and professionals who are able to step in early. So I think at the moment we have an extraordinary opportunity in Australia at the moment because we've got governments at both state and Commonwealth levels looking to make big investments in universal early learning, and as well as in things like healthy child development. So you will have heard Minister Butler talk a couple of weeks ago about something called Thriving Kids. And I think what those big investments are is that they are ways of sort of stop seeing kids as things that need to be fixed over there and instead investing in the adults who are around kids most of the time, the parents, the educators, the teachers. And if we can invest in those, and that's where kids spend most of their time and it's where their brains are growing and it's where they're learning all of these skills, then actually, as Ross's work so powerfully shows, we can really set kids up for a much better trajectory in life.
We're talking so much about early years here. It's so interesting to sort of think about the issues that we see mostly in, I suppose, teenagers and young adults starting here. Ross, we've seen in Queensland the Chris Afulli government's announced three crime prevention schools in Townsville, Ipswich and Rockhampton. These are obviously high schools, years 7 to 12. Is this too late?
Well, look, the mantra of the criminologist is never too early, never too late. It's never too late to introduce supportive services, getting kids back on track. So essentially I support these, what I can read about the crime prevention schools. Let me just emphasise, though, that there's been huge efforts put in through the Department of Education and through other systems for the education of kids in detention or in community-based supervision, although we have increasing numbers in Queensland of kids actually locked up, and that's the current reality, 90% of whom, I should add, are not sentenced.
Do you want to unpack that a bit?
Well, they're on remand. They haven't yet, their court case hasn't come up yet. 90% of all the children in youth detention are not sentenced for, they may have a long previous history, but for the current offence or offences, they haven't had their day in court. So that means actually the legal powers to, you can't require kids who haven't been, as it were, they don't use the word convicted, but found guilty of the of an offence to do anything. Now, most do, I gather. The real problem is resourcing. One of my issues with the crime prevention schools is that it doesn't really acknowledge the enormous efforts that have already gone in. I know some of the trained education department teachers who do this sort of work with kids in detention, and it's really positive. So yes, let's have more of it. I don't know whether special crime prevention schools is the way to go. We'll have to find out. I would like to see this very rigorously and independently evaluated. I mean, one of the things that really, really annoys me about government, and this is true for Labor and LNP, you know, they're talking about a decade of skyrocketing youth offending. It's highly politicised. Look, can we get away from that? I mean, it isn't. It's just wrong. We don't have skyrocketing youth offending under Labor. It was going down and it's still going down. In fact, fewer kids than ever in this country are getting into trouble with the police. That's the bottom line. Anyway, look, as you could gather, I could get really steamed up on this and go all day. Yes, basically, I endorse this initiative. They're certainly making the right sorts of noises. The schools will deliver structured and supportive environments that combine tailored learning with life skills development. But let it be integrated as much as possible with the community the children will have to return to. And that's one of my issues with special schools, that they could be isolated and labelled.
Yeah, knowing that you're in the crime prevention high school or that your kid's going to the crime prevention high school feels a little,
that's right,
little pointed.
Yeah.
So, Caroline, from your perspective and based on the findings of your report that you've just released, what would you like to see happen next?
Yeah, so I think to Ross's point, what we know is that actually our education systems and our health systems often have some really helpful pathways that can take us through. So I was thinking, as Ross was talking about, schools I know in South Australia who started doing basic reading screeners of kids entering high school and discovering that in some of those really low SES areas, as many as 70 to 80% of kids don't have basic literacy skills. And then we're surprised that they're having trouble sitting still in classroom and not acting out. So I think schools and early learning services and maternal child and health services, all of these services actually have instincts about how to support children effectively to build out those skills and to support their families. I think what we need to do is we need to take seriously the idea that we're going to have to enrich these universal systems. And I know that feels impossibly big. I know it feels like, well, how on earth can we get all of our schools and all of our early learning centres to be able to provide these sort of extra supports around communication development? I think what our report shows is that the cost of doing it the way we're doing it now is much, much higher. And we're not just seeing that in youth justice, we're seeing that in child protection, we're seeing that in the flight of families of children with developmental delay or autism turning to the NDIS, even though it's not super well designed for sort of early childhood intervention, because they don't trust that their community-based services, the things that they use every day, will be there to help when they need. So I think for me, what I am really heartened by is I'm hearing both the Commonwealth and the states talk about investing big big in our big universal services to enable that kind of enriched and progressive response to the needs of children. So that's what I'm hoping for, and I'm really looking forward to some more work on that in the coming year.
Caroline Ross, thank you both so much. Dr. Caroline Krauser-Barlow is the CEO of the FRONT Project, who co-authored the Cost of Late Intervention Report. And Emeritus Professor Ross Hommel is the now retired Foundation Professor of Criminology and Criminal Justice at Griffith University, who led a decades-long early intervention and early prevention program in Queensland.
Stream any ABC radio station live and on the go. Discover new podcasts, music and audiobooks, all free on the ABC Listen app.